And of course, we're by keeping these days, we don't forget, because we do it every year and kind of rehearses it again from the time of Israel leaving Egypt that's brought out, and also how we're coming out of spiritual Egypt today. And Pharaoh was a type of Satan. Egypt was a type of the world or sin. And certainly they were to live by a different standard. The new covenant is old covenant, and then the new covenant later, as we see. We know that when you get rid of something, you have to replace it with something else. I mean, that's pretty much a law when you look around chemically or in human experiences. For instance, you have a glass of water, and I don't see a glass of water.
They're on the side.
Somebody got a glass of water? Over here. Oh, that's where it's hiding.
That's the wrong one.
And I've drunk a little bit of this water, but I replaced it with something else. What was that? Air. Air. It's always something. It comes in to replace something that's been taken away. And we are to get rid of sin. Take sin out of our lives. That's what we're learning from these days, 11, which it talks about in 1 Corinthians 5, where it says, have the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, rather than the leaven of malice and wickedness, which is sin, of course. So God tells us to, we, in principle, that we should get rid of sin in our lives by even this festival that we learn so much more from in the New Testament than even from the time of Moses. It is a wonderful thing to know that and understand it, what we need to be doing in our lives. But when you get rid of sin, just like everything else, you have to replace it with something else. And if it's something bad, it would seem like it's better to replace it with something good, right? Or if you replace it with something else bad, where have you gained? What have you gained? Even the Alcoholics Anonymous outfits, you know, you have to replace alcoholism with other things, good things. And so we see that the same way. The principle is there. When we get rid of sin, if we don't replace it with something else, then it'll come right back. It'll come right back. And that certainly is bad. We've seen that even happen in the church over centuries, over even in our lifetimes, where people who have come out of sin for a while, and then they went back into it. And sometimes ended up worse than they were before. Their lives, some ended up in prison. Some ended up suicide. Some ended up doing other things. Other people, not so bad. It depended. But certainly, in some cases, worse than if they had not even known the truth, as the Bible brings out. So we have to replace the sin with something good, something right. And the Bible calls or tells us that this thing that we are to replace it with is righteousness. Replacing sin with righteousness. I want to ask you today then, what kind of righteousness? What kind? Well, you say, Woody, there's only one kind. No, I've seen that there's actually, when you boil it all down, there's only two kinds of righteousness. In real life and in the Bible and all that. There's only two. And it's rather interesting. And they're all over. Both kinds are in the world. But one kind predominates. And so let's look at this. Let's look at the different kinds of righteousness, the two kinds of righteousness today, and analyze them a little bit more. I think you're going to find that the one kind of righteousness we're talking about, first of all, is a lot more pervasive, universal, than you ever have realized. We all had it, and we still have some of it as human beings. I'm sorry to say, because we are still human. The other kind is good. We need to have that kind. But let's look at these things. I have been studying a little bit more into Genesis, and as was brought out already this morning by Mr. Ballow, Genesis 3. Genesis means start or beginning of life. Genesis. And if you look at the book of Genesis, it's the beginning of many things in society. Beginning of murder. Beginning of building big cities. Beginnings of nations. Beginning of sin. Beginning of God's law. When you look at it a little more closely. All kinds of beginnings here in the book of Genesis. So we should go back to the beginning, as Mr. Armstrong used to say, and find out where we get these things and why. And Genesis, the third chapter, we see, first of all, if you want the background, you see Genesis 1 and 2, it talks about God's creation. And you see over and over, God says, and it was very good. Notice, yielding its seed, every herb, it was very good, good for food and so forth. Blessed the day and the night. And it was very good. Everything God did here was righteous. It was good. It was beneficial. And certainly we get into that. And then we get to chapter 3 and we find some different change of the story or what happened when the serpent came along. Devil, Satan. Very cunning, verse 1 of chapter 3, more than any other kind of beast in the field. And this beast was able to talk. A serpent, a fiery serpent, it says in another place in the Bible, actually Satan, coming in the guise of an animal. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? A question mark. Got her interested in the subject. And engaged her on the level of God. So God must have just taught her some things, her husband or Adam. And it was still in her mind what was just said about different things by God, teaching them things. So he comes right in on the subject, which is still fresh in her mind. Didn't he say you can't eat of every tree of the garden? Did he tell you that? Really? And you believed him? Yeah, I believed him, sure. And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. And then all of us are very well acquainted with the first lie recorded in the Bible. And that's in verse 4. The serpent said to the woman, you shall not surely die. Well, she didn't. For a while. She didn't die that night. She didn't die the next week. She didn't die next month. She didn't die the next 100 years. All in case she lived probably for hundreds of years. But she eventually died. Right? And then it says in Romans 3 that all die and come short. They all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Romans 3:23 and Romans 6:23. And it says all people die. All that sin is the wages of sin is death. And all, since all sin, then they all must die. And that is true. Have we seen it in history? Nobody survived 2,000 years. Mel Brooks on the notwithstanding, 2,000-year-old man. That's a comedy. That's all it is. You shall surely die. Now, a lot of people think, and it's real easy to go over verse 5, but verse 5 has four more lies in it. Four more lies. It's interesting when you start analyzing it carefully. And I'm going to show you what they are. Because he quotes God and says God knows these things. And what he says God knows are lies. God doesn't know these. He knows these are lies that are said. And we'll show you closely. He says, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open. You'll be able to see like he does. Not true. That's a lie. That's lie number two. Your eyes will be open. No, your eyes will be closed. Your eyes will be blinded. 2 Corinthians 4:4 says that Satan has blinded the people of the world. He deceived the whole world, it says in Revelation. He has blinded the eyes of people. He's closed their eyes. He says, when you go this way, I'm telling you about, your eyes are going to be open. No, they're going to be closed. They're going to be blinded to the truth of God. And the second thing he says, and you will be like God. That's a third lie. Lie number three, you'll be like God. How will they be like God? Well, God is righteous. Will they be righteous? You'll be like God. No, you won't be like God. When you don't do what he says and wants you to do, you're not going to be like him. And the Bible just shows very clearly that, you know, murderers and whoremongers and deviants and so forth in the book of Revelation will not be there forever. The ones who are going to make it are the righteous, like God is righteous. That's how you can become like God, become righteous, not unrighteous. And this guy is telling them that you'll be like God if you go your own way here, as he goes on. That was in lie number three. You'll be like God. No, you won't be like God at all. So, and then number four, knowing good from evil. No, they won't. See, they will decide what is good and evil themselves. That's what he's telling them. You don't need God. You don't need somebody telling you what to do. You can figure that out yourself. You got brains. You're smart. Right? You can devise. You can rationalize and figure things out on your own. You're not dummies. He was appealing to their human, emotions. You're good people. You know, you can do this. It's a challenge, but you can do it. You can know good from evil. No, you can't. You can't know good from evil yourself. Only God can reveal what is good and evil, what is righteous and what is unrighteous. Man can only guess, right? You can only guess with your own human nature, with your own human spirit, what is right and what is wrong. For who? For you. Now, that's what people say. If it worked for me, I'm happy. You have your belief, I have my belief, but this works for me. For me. For myself. And you know what that is? It's self-righteousness. Where a person comes up to see that I figure myself what is righteous and what is not righteous. And all of us have this, that we, what you call, rationalize whatever we do. That is so easy to do. A man will even do some evil and rationalize it. I did it because. Well, even Adam and Eve do it, don't they? The reason I did this is because the woman gave me the fruit. So, you know, I'm innocent, Adam said, but here she was and she offered, so it's her fault. And I'm really a good person. That's self-righteousness. What about her? She says, well, Satan told me this, and so then I took the apple or whatever it was, a fruit, and I ate. So it's the devil's fault. Well, he's involved. Sure, he is, has his fault, and he has his bad influence. But she's the one who went ahead and ate it and gave it to her husband, too. But she says, well, I'm good, I'm clean, I'm right, but here's a bad influence on me. Blaming somebody else. That happens all the time if you look in the world. People rationalize why or why they didn't do certain things. And they always come out squeaky white, usually. Go to a prisoner sometime and ask how many of those prisoners are in there are innocent. Interesting. It's very interesting. And they find out most of the prisoners in prison will not admit they did whatever they did. Some will. But most of them will say, I was with this gang, and they went, I was along with them, and we all got arrested, and I didn't shoot the guy, I just looked, and I didn't know he was going to shoot him, and I'm really innocent, but I'm in here wrongfully. You know? And, I mean, whatever you do, you can rationalize it away. I don't keep the Sabbath because I have to work for a living and my kids need shoes. Right? Well, they're right. The kids need shoes, they need food, they need a place to live, and maybe he doesn't make much money. That's true. But then he'll say, well, I want to keep the Sabbath. I know it's right. Oh, it's on a seventh day, whatever. But it's too hard for me because I got to take care of my family. No faith, of course, is involved here. I can't tithe. I'd like to tithe. I want to give to God, but I don't make enough money. Years ago, there was a minister who was with Worldwide, and he was rationalizing why people shouldn't have to tithe all over the world because of different circumstances. And he says, you know, in Africa, the average income for a person is like $500 a year. They can't afford to come to church. They have to take a bicycle because they can't afford gas, or they can't have a car. They don't have a car. They barely have a roof over their head. Yes, that's true. How could anybody tithe on $500 a year? $50, he said. Well, there's a lot of people that tithe on a lot less than that. They don't have even $500 a year. They still, we have people in a church over in Africa who don't make that much money. In fact, they don't even make hardly any money. They just grow their own crops in their backyard, and they have a few goats and, you know, whatever, and they make a few things, maybe sell it to somebody, and that's how they live. They don't have a regular job. But they still honor God with a tithe. And somehow God keeps them alive and helps them. Well, anyway, that takes faith too. But people will rationalize and saying, I know what's good and what's evil for me or my country or whatever. You can take it on a national basis too, international basis, but you find that leaders of countries feel the same way. What is good for my country? Should I attack that country before they attack me? And they substantiate whatever they do, their decision, based on rational thoughts. And it's self-interest. Self-interest of the nation, they say it's in. Well, I'll give you some terrible examples. Hitler believed that the Sudeten Czechoslovakians, who were mostly Germans, Osterreich, they're from the east. Millions of people lived there in Czechoslovakia, who were on the west side, who were mostly Germans. They outnumbered the Czechs in that part of the country. So he said, well, that isn't fair for those people to have a different country and not have the rights that we have in Germany for Germans. So that part of the country should be a part of the Reich, part of Germany. And so they made a deal in 1938. It sounded very, very rational as far as the Germans are concerned. The Germans there in Czechoslovakia liked the idea. They welcomed the troops into Prague and so forth. There's no problem there. And then other things they did. Oh, look, over here you've got East Prussia. That is now run by Poland. I know actually Poland has this land all around it. It's all by itself over in the east. It's separated from Germany. It's part of Germany. Yes, East Prussia. It's over on the Baltic. And now it's part of Poland again. But back then, he said, I want to go through the Polish corridor. The distance between Germany and Prussia should be opened up to us. Well, they had a highway, went back and forth. People could still get there and back from East Prussia to Germany, no problem. They weren't stopped by the Polish to use that. They wanted to have that whole corridor, Hitler says. And for the first time, somebody said no to Hitler. Polish said, no, you can't have that. You can't have our land back. And so they went to war. But Hitler thought he was perfectly righteous in doing this. And you read anything he wrote, he believed what he's doing was good. It's good for the German people and the whole world if he took it over. He didn't think he was a bad man. He thought he was a good man. That's self-righteousness. And doing evil at the same time. It's so interesting when you look at these things. Now, that isn't the only thing. Really, the line number 5, actually it's number 2 when you look at it, says, notice the first 3 words of chapter 5, verse 5. For God knows. In other words, he's quoting God. God has this knowledge that if you have your eyes are open and you're being like God and it's no good from evil. God knows something here. Yes, he does. He knows these things are all lies. They're all lies. And Satan has influenced people to believe these lies that you can direct your own thoughts, whatever they are, religious, educational, political, or whatever, your way, because you, mankind, are smart. You don't need God to tell you what to do. It's self-righteousness. It's so interesting when you look at it. Most people don't think they're doing a great evil thing. If somebody steals things, even, will rationalize why they're stealing. I'm poor. I don't have any money. My kids are starving. I need more money. I can't get a job. Go on and on, right? It all sounds, I can see that. One time I heard a guy who stole some things from Safeway stores up in Sedalia, Missouri. That's where Scott Joplin used to be in our church area up there at that time. And they were going to one of these rock festivals like they had up in, New York years ago? What would they call that? Anyway, Woodstock. Yeah, but they had a kind of a festival over there in that little town in Missouri. And this one fellow came there for that. He says, we don't have any money, so we just went into Safeway and start taking things off the shelf, something to eat and so forth. And so the reporter says, why'd you do that? He says, Safeway steals from us already. They make lots of money, off us, poor customers. And so, it's just par for the course to steal something back from them. He rationalized why he stole things from Safeway or Walmart today or whatever, all these shoplifters. I'm sure they think they're righteous. I got to feed the kids. I need something, whatever. I'm not getting rich, And they sound like, they're doing something bad, but, it's the way it's not so bad. That's human nature. And that's self-righteousness. It's a pervasive, interesting thing. So God knows, all right, he knows that these things that are said about him are what he knows them to be false and not true at all. But people have bought that, self-righteousness. You decide. You think for yourself. Self-righteousness is really false righteousness or unrighteousness when you really look at it. It gives license for people to do things that they think are good or right. People keep Christmas every year. They think that's righteous, don't they? Well, they're deceived, but they think that's a good thing. It shows respect for Christ. And, it's good to give things to other people and have this feeling of, of brotherhood and giving and all that. Those are all seemingly good things of themselves. They can't see where it could possibly be wrong or a sin. They can't see where Easter would be a sin. They can't see where a lot of things are sin. They would never believe that until God had opened their mind to see it. And that's yet in the future for most people. Your okay, I'm okay mentality, or I'm better than you, we don't do this like you guys do it, that's self-righteousness too. There's all kinds of forms of self-righteousness, but it basically comes from one general invention back here in Genesis as far as Satan is concerned. You know, Satan, you wonder how he got one-third of the angels to go after him. He must have lied to them, too. He must have told them, bill of goods, like a con man, and says, you come follow me and we'll take over heaven, you know. And they tried to do that, remember? They went against heaven, against where God himself is. And it didn't work. He was cast down to earth, remember, with his buddies. Now they're not very happy. You can see that. They're foaming out their shame and so forth. They want to die if they can. Their lives are not good because they followed sin. They followed self-righteousness that they have. And you look at what Satan does. He is very self-righteous when you read about the places in the Bible where he's spoken of. What about the book of Job, for instance? He's more righteous than God, he thinks. He is wrong, of course. Nobody's more righteous than God. But you know what he says? He look at my servant Job, God says. Look what he's doing. He's a righteous man. He's a man without a blame. He helps people. He's a good citizen. He obeys me, keeps my commandments. He was a person of high integrity, very high integrity. And then Satan comes along and says, yeah, but he doesn't do it for nothing. He does it because you put a hedge around him and you help him. You protect him from all these enemies and so forth. And so he's doing it just because he gets something out of it. He's going to get a profit from it. He's going to make more money. He's going to have more friends. He's going to have more land. He's going to have more cattle, more kids. So why wouldn't he do what you tell him to do? Go take away this hedge and his protection and then see what he does. Of course, his wife didn't help him because she says to him, after he was struck down, she said to Job, she says, why don't you curse God and die? Not a good influence either. And he says, how can I do that? God gives and God takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord, he said. And he didn't charge God with wrongdoing. He knew God was righteous. But I like to read a little bit from something that's quite interesting. I looked up a little bit lately in this regard. This is an article that's on the webpage of the American Humanist Association. Have you heard of humanists? People who believe in humanism. What is that? And it's interesting. It's called the American Humanist Association. You know what their model is? Their motto. Good without a God. Yes, good without a God. Of course, that can't happen. You can't have good without God. Matthew 19, verse 16 and 17, Christ even brings that out. But here's a good example of self-righteousness. It's all over the world. Communists had humanism. Communists believe in this idea a man can solve his own problems. He doesn't need God. Don't wait for him. Because he probably doesn't exist anyway. Or doesn't exist anyway. What is humanism? We can have a number of meanings, it says, because authors and speakers often don't clarify what meaning they intend. And it becomes a source of confusion. Interesting. Who's the author of confusion? Satan, right? But here are some different kinds of humanism they have, people have. Renaissance humanism is a spirit of learning that developed in the end of the Middle Ages with the revival of classical letters and a renewed confidence in the ability of human beings to determine for themselves truth and falsehood. Does that sound like Genesis 3, verse 5? They can determine the ability, renewed confidence in the ability of human beings to determine for themselves, self-righteousness, truth and falsehood, good and evil. I mean, you can't get closer to that than what the Renaissance was, some Renaissance. Western cultural humanism is a good name for the rational and empirical, whatever that means, tradition that originated largely in ancient Greece and Rome. Ancient Greece and Rome. Evolved through European history and now constitutes a basic part of the Western approach to science, political theory, ethics, and law. It still is a basic part of the Western approach to science, political theory, ethics, and law. It comes from largely Greek and Roman culture. That's what we have in the West. You go into universities and see if it isn't from that approach. I think I told you about what happened to me in philosophy class. Right down there. Philosophical humanism is another kind, is any outlook or way of life centered on human need and interest. Human need and interest. Christian humanism is defined in Webster's dictionary as a philosophy advocating a self-fulfillment of man. Self-fulfillment of man within the framework of Christian principles. Product of the Renaissance and so forth. Humanism. Modern humanism, called other things, scientific humanism and so forth, is a natural philosophy that rejects all supernaturalism. What's supernaturalism? Outside what's natural, outside of nature. In other words, miracles, spirit beings, kind of like the Sadducees didn't believe in spirit beings, did they? Or the resurrection. Well, these guys don't either. They don't believe in angels. They don't believe in anything that you can't explain physically. They couldn't explain miracles, in other words. A naturalistic philosophy that rejects supernaturalism and relies primarily upon reason and science, democracy, and human compassion. Relies on human compassion? Does that work? Sometimes. But most of the time, it doesn't. War, is that human compassion? I don't think you define war as a lot of human compassion. There is human compassion in war. The nurses, the ambulances, the people who try to save people's lives who've been wounded. Yes, there is compassion. Some people do save people's lives, but most of it is evil. Secular humanism, outgrowth of 18th century enlightenment, rationalism in the 19th century free thought. Don't want to read all this, but to read a little bit of it. Religious humanist says, in realizing this, make sure that doctrine is never allowed to subvert the higher purpose of meeting human needs in the here and now. Did you notice that? Doctrine never is allowed to subvert or interfere, let's put it that way, in the higher purpose of meeting human needs in the here and now. What's doctrine? Doctrine is teaching, isn't it? What are you taught? What are you learning? The Ten Commandments is teaching, isn't it? It's doctrine. Loving your neighbor as yourself is doctrine. I don't think that interferes with helping people here and now. Loving your neighbor as yourself. But that's doctrine. Oh, watch out for doctrine. And then finally here, I've got humanism teaches us that it is immoral, listen to this, to wait for God and act for us. It's immoral to wait for God and to act for us. We must act to stop the wars and the crimes and the brutality of this and future ages. We have powers of a remarkable kind. We have a high degree of freedom in choosing what we will do. Humanism tells us that whatever our philosophy of the universe may be, ultimately the responsibility for the kind of world we live in rests with us. Self-righteousness. We all band together, we can stop wars. United Nations, League of Nations. real success, right? How many wars have we had since the United Nations was started in 1945? Outgrowth of the League of Nations, which is what our president's own idea, Mr. Woodrow Wilson. But Congress wouldn't let us in. We were not a member of it, believe it or not. We're the ones who came up with our president, 14 points. So there will be no more wars, that we'd all get together and talk things over as nations and don't go to war anymore. First World War, then it was called the War to End All Wars. Famous last words, right? And then, of course, Mr. Armstrong, you know, he went to the starting session, whatever you call it, of the United Nations back in San Francisco, 1945, I believe. He was a reporter. And he reported on that. Remember that very well. And certainly, man, then, humans, will solve their own problems. And that is what Satan told them. You don't need God. You can figure yourself what is right and wrong, what works and what doesn't. Now, it's interesting about the one about knowing good from evil. It's kind of a half lie. It's a half lie, because sometimes people can discover what is good, and they can do that on their own too. And other times, and they can find out what is evil, doesn't work. And all countries have a certain amount of understanding on these things, but not wholly, not completely. Even in Romans 2, it talks about the Gentiles, even though laws on their own, even though they don't have law of God in those countries. For instance, they might have a law against stealing. That's one of the Ten Commandments. A law against false witness, or what do you call it, perjury in court, at least. They have laws against that, perjury. They have laws against stealing, right? About every nation, I don't care what ism it is, there's laws against stealing. Sometimes they'll kill you for stealing a loaf of bread. Other times they will, whatever. There's laws against a lot of things. But there aren't laws against all the things that God says are wrong to do, or laws showing what to do. They get part of it, but they don't get it all. We find examples of self-righteousness in the Bible. Luke 18, verse 9. Let's look at this. And, of course, we're well acquainted with some of these in the Bible, but they only tell you part of the story sometimes in different places, and you add them up, and then you find out quite something more. Luke 18, verse 9. This is really a good guy. He was very righteous. I don't know anybody in church that's been this righteous. You might know somebody, but I sure don't. And in fact, I don't think I want to know a person like this when it gets down to it. I'm very suspicious of a person to be like this, because I'd ask the question, why does he do these things? You know something? When he analyzes, he's outrighteousing God, this guy. Well, let's look at this example. Luke 18, verse 9, talking about a Pharisee, verse 9. He spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that, what? They were righteous. That they were righteous. And, of course, we can point the finger at all these people. But I think there's four fingers pointed out back sometimes. And despise others. You know, usually they do look down on other people who are really self-righteous, because their self is better than the other selves. That's why they're better. They're righteous. Oh, I'd never do that. Oh, yes, I can't. Oh, you listen to that music? I couldn't. Oh, not me. I'll never do that. I won't take my kids to do this and that. You take your kids? Oh, I can't see how you could do something like that. You know, it's very, very much around. Anyway, I take my kids to church every Sunday morning. They never miss. Of course, they miss the point. But then you go on, verse 12, he says, I fast twice a week. fast twice a week. That's 2 out of 7. That's about a third of the week, isn't it? Do you have to fast that often? And twice in a week, every 3 days, you have to, 3.5 days, you have to fast. Why? Are you that far away from God? You never pray, you never study, you don't care about what God says, and so you feel so bad about it, every 3.5 days you're going to fast again about it? There's something else wrong with this guy. Maybe he is so far away from God, he feels bad once in a while, so he, every 3.5 days, and he fasts again. He doesn't say he fasts all week, he fasts, doesn't say how long. Maybe it's one meal. We don't know. Doesn't tell you that part. Okay. And I want to ask the question, what else does this guy do? God never asked you to fast twice in a week. He tells us to fast once a year. He says, and Christ brought out when you fast, talking to his disciples. So we should fast, but he doesn't tell you how often, does he? Nothing about that. That's up to you, up to how you feel about your relationship with God and other things that come up maybe. Okay, and then he did the second thing was really interesting to me. When you really analyze it more specifically, I give tithes of all that I possess. Do we give tithes of all we possess? Mr. Ballard, do you give a tithe on your value of your house? Do you give tithes on the value of your car? Do you tithe on your increase? Yes, that's what God said to do. But this guy tithed on everything he possessed. A guy came into church one time and he says, Mr. Rand, I'm going to tithe on everything I got. This really happened, believe it or not. I said, you don't have to do that. What do you mean? He says, well, you learned about tithing recently and understood it and believed it. Yes. Well, you should tithe on your increase. How much profit or how much you have left over after, you know, you get your income from your paycheck or whatever, how it works out, and maybe interest, you maybe get some interest from that, what your increase is. Oh, yeah. Well, he said, you don't have to. He said, I want to. I said, you can do it if you want. There's no law against it, but there's no law that says you have to either. And it's interesting. There's this guy tithed and all he possessed. Well, what a good guy. He's more righteous than what God tells you to be. I really am very, very dubious about such a person. They're too good. And when they're too good, they're too bad, too. Now, what does he say about these Pharisees? Let's look over to Matthew 23. Self-righteous. They are more righteous than God sometimes. They think. There's no such thing. You can't be more righteous than God. In fact, it says in one place, don't be righteous over much, doesn't it? Over much righteous. Don't be so concerned, but everything is just exactly right that you overdo it. What about those people who gave the gifts to the temple? Matthew 5. Were they pretty righteous? And Christ says, why don't you take care of the folks? You're leaving them starving over here someplace, and here you're giving all this money to the temple because you don't have money for, so you don't have money, Corban, it's a gift, so you can't give it to your folks to help them in their old age, honor your father and your mother. So you disable the fifth commandment in your mind. That's not as important as giving money to the church, giving money to the temple. But, of course, everybody knew he did because he told everybody. So he's getting his reward. But the thing is, he was sinning, breaking God's law. One of the Ten Commandments, taking care of his folks and honoring them so he could give gifts to the temple. God didn't want your gifts that much. You know, that doesn't make a lot of points. Remember what he said about bulls and goats? He brought that up this morning. God doesn't have pleasure in that. Blood and guts and all that stuff. It was a type of Christ that would come to pay the penalty once for all. And those people back then, they could understand that a little bit more. They knew Messiah had to come someday. I don't know if they understood about his death or not. Some did, certainly, in the future. But Matthew 23, in verse 13 to 15. 23:13. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, but you neither go in yourself, neither do you allow others to enter therein. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You look good on the outside, he said, like whitewashed sepulchers, but inside full of rotten bones. Inside your lives is rotten. What did they do, for instance? Listen to what he says. For you devour widows' houses. They stole money from these poor little widows. Con men, crooks. Well, about the worst kind of criminal is to take advantage of some poor old ladies and poor old people, like in Florida here. It happens all the time. You devour widows' houses and for pretense make long prayers so you receive greater condemnation. In other words, you show off that you're really religious. Pray in public, bend down in public to show people that you're really honoring God. You're so sacred. You're so wonderful. And your pile of, never mind. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, because you travel land to get all these proselytes and so forth. And then verse 27 and 28 really tells you. They're righteous. They're self-righteous. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you play actors. For you're like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outward, inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. And then verse 28 is really the clincher. You look so righteous, you want to think you're righteous. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inwardly you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness, sin. You're full of sin, full of breaking God's law privately. That's hypocritical. Sinning privately, but publicly looking good. We've had people in the church that way. I've seen them come and go. They were top speakers sometimes in a spokesman's club. They seem like really fine people. But then you found out in their lives, they were doing things, saying things, or taking God's name in vain. You couldn't believe it was the same person who's coming to church. So outwardly, they look really fine people. They were very courteous, and they helped, and they were serving. Sometimes the biggest servers in the church, locally. And if anybody told you they were doing these things on the side that were breaking God's law, you'd say, oh, that can't be them. Child perverts we've had in church. Found out about them, and people, when they heard that person, that man was messing around with his grandchildren, said, oh, that guy, he couldn't do that. That man would never do that. He's a fine man. He's a good member. You could trust him. I trust him with whatever. But his own family brought that out to me once. Looked really good on the outside, but he was a piece of junk. He's the most rotten type of person there is, to do perversion things to your children or anybody else. And full of sin. Well, God finds those. The sin finds them out, and finally they're gone, unless they repent. How about Isaiah 64, verse 6? 64, verse 6. This is an interesting part of Isaiah because it's quoted a lot, but I don't think with understanding sometimes. And it's really, when you get the context of it, it isn't just self-righteousness, it's sin at the same time. You can't be righteous and sin at the same time. It doesn't work. Isaiah 64, verse 6. And this is an admission by Israelites. And I'm sure we'll see that coming up in the White Throne Judgment when Israel is raised from the dead. It says, we are all like an unclean thing, and all our righteousness is like filthy rags, and all fade as a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, have taken us away. No one calls on your name, stirs himself to take hold of you, God, for you have hidden your face from us. Now, they're even self-righteous in this. You have consumed us because of our iniquities. So twice it talks about iniquities. or lawlessness or sin. So here they are, our righteousness is filthy rags. They come to admit that because they see our righteousness is not righteousness, it's false righteousness or pseudo-righteousness or substitute righteousness, but it isn't true righteousness. Now, here in Romans 10, we find another kind of righteousness. Romans 10, verse 3. This is what true Christians should aspire to or work for. It's all of us, I think we know. Not self-righteousness, but some other kind. Romans 10, verse 3. This is what we replace sin with in our lives. Else, what's the point? If you stop sinning and you don't have anything positive to replace it with, something good is versus something bad, it was sin, what have you accomplished? Nothing. In fact, the Bible says you might even get worse, as it has happened. Romans 10, verse 3. It says, for they, this be talking about zeal for God, about Israel, about Judah. He says, they being ignorant of God's righteousness. And that's what people are overall. They're ignorant of God's righteousness. It's quite a different kind. And seeking to establish what? You read it there, their own. That's what people have done since Satan has started the whole ball going, rolling, back there in Genesis. They have substituted and established their own righteousness and have not submitted to the righteousness of God. That's the other kind of righteousness, righteousness of God. That's what she'd be attaining, not self-righteousness, because that's no good. That's in error. That's full of dead man's bones. That's sin. And so here the church of God and the churches of God, and let's put it that way too, that had come to see we should keep the commandments of God and testimony of Christ and to seek God's righteousness, not our own righteousness that we've had in the past or still partly have today. I know myself. I've done the self-righteous bit too. I've rationalized why I didn't keep the Sabbath at times. Or why this and that. Everybody has to look at it. And the thing is, we need to do is we need to look at righteousness from God's point of view. And it's quite different than the righteousness that self-righteousness is. That's the way we view it ourselves. This is how I look at it. Mr. Armstrong used to say, my opinion is as worthless as yours. Opinion. Now, and even criminals will come, they've been in prison or they've got incarcerated because of some crime they did. And so now they come out and some actually reform themselves. They actually say, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to get involved with crime anymore. I'm going to go straight, get a job, blah, blah, blah. It's hard, but they do it. And they actually probably become pretty good citizens. In fact, it sounded interesting. A parole officer told us one time in Spokesman's Club, he was a parole officer for one of our own members who had used to be in prison for 8 years, now ex-con. And he said that from the records, what they find is that the ones who made the best citizens after they got out of prison, guess who they were? You'll never believe it. But he said, these are the ones that came, when they came back into society, they were the best citizens. Those who murdered somebody. Yeah. Those who killed somebody. Usually they killed somebody because it was emotional. It was maybe over marriage or some got angry or mad or got drunk or other things. But usually they're pretty sad and really feel terrible that they did this, that they killed somebody in the past. And if it was a type of thing that wasn't punishable by, you know, death, and they had a long prison term, but they had good, behavior, Maybe they got out in 30 years or less. Some places as low as 7 years for homicide. Can you believe it? Up in Chicago, heard about sentences were that short for somebody who killed somebody. In other places, 30 years down in Alabama. You know, the law isn't equal wherever you are. Anyway, the thing is, some will try to make up for their bad doings by doing good things. But that doesn't pay for their bad doings in the past. That's where Christ was willing to do that, to wipe the slate clean from our past sins. As you know, we can't pay for our own sins, as we all know. They say we have a works-based faith, other churches. Some worldwide say that. We are a works-based faith in the churches of God who left them and believe in keeping the commandments. Yes, we are works-based. I thought about that. Based on the workmanship of Jesus Christ living within us. That's the workmanship. Not ourselves, that we're such great, wonderful people, and we do wonderful works, and so now God's going to let us into the kingdom. You know, we have big funds we put together so we can save people from malaria over in Africa, or HIV, or like the, you know, what are their names? Gates, wife and husband, things like that. And they are helping people. Of course, you look at the families over there, got 10, 12 kids, and they're dirt poor, and you're helping them actually have more kids, and more poverty, and more pain and sorrow. One lady said she's glad she came into church because she's not raped anymore. That was in Africa. Can you believe that? Yeah, Fred Keller's wife told us when they were over there years ago. She's so grateful that she's in a church now that somebody won't rape her. What a world, huh? What a world. Far worse than we might realize sometimes. Satan's world. But the second type of righteousness is looking at it God's way. What is righteous to God? What are those people over there like to God? What are they doing? What does God think of what they're doing? Got to look at it from his standpoint, from his view, and then you're following God's righteousness. Not human righteousness. That's in error many times. Or partly in error. Partly, like Satan has taken some truth and he takes error and puts it together sometimes and really confuses people. You can say, oh, we're helping people over here. We're helping them to eat or giving them something to eat. Is that evil or bad? No, that's good. And you have to agree, that is a good thing to help them. But that doesn't make up for following what God says to do in other areas of your life. Right? Like keeping what he said to do, keeping the Ten Commandments. One of my friends in Boca Raton was talking about, he married a Jewish lady. He's Catholic himself. And he used to go over to Boca Raton, and one time he went over to some kind of a party or something they had, and they're Anglo-Saxons, they call them over there in Boca Raton, Anglo-Saxons and Jews. They're both there. So we're all Anglo-Saxons, I guess, if we're not Jews. Anyway, and one person didn't know his wife was Jewish, and so he starts making some bad remarks about Jewish people. And so Bill says, listen, my wife is Jewish. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, backed up. And he said, well, I don't like the comments you made, blah, 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 you know. And would we look at it that way, as a righteous person, look at it that way from God's point of view? Or would they say, I made all of you guys. I love you all. I'm not a respecter of persons. That's the way God looks at that point thing. See what I mean? That's one example of self-righteousness versus God's righteousness. It's only one small example compared. So self-righteousness and God's righteousness goes a lot more deeper and more profoundly than people would realize. And I think we need to realize that. The second type of righteousness is all over. If you want to see some wonderful things about God's righteousness, it's over in Psalm 119. Is one place you can look over and over again, it tells you all kinds of proclivities of God's righteousness, what it's like. What are different aspects of God's righteousness? Is it sin? Is it breaking God's law? Is it hurting people? Is it going to war or, in this modern age, whatever? Psalm 119. It's all about God's law. The longest psalm in the Bible. And it's for good reason. Because David loved God's law. It's his meditation all the day, he said. He thought about different provisions of the Ten Commandments and other parts of the law, too. He talks about statutes here. He talks about judgments. He talks about the testimony of God. And the New Testament in the book of Revelation says the true church will be keeping the commandments of God and the testimony of Christ. And they'd be following Christ. This is Mr. like Mr. Franks just said in the letter we just got. If you read it yet, it's a wonderful letter. And he talked about when he first came into church, he was baptized in Big Sandy and so forth. But knew that he was supposed to follow Christ the rest of his life. I think all of us have felt that way and know that, I hope, when we were baptized. Psalm 119, verse 172. My tongue shall speak of your word, for all your commandments are righteousness. There's a definition of righteousness. Keeping God's commandments is righteousness in God's sight. Not man's sight, certainly. Because man will make all kinds of rationales why we don't have to keep these commandments, or some of them anyway. Why we don't have to keep the one about taking God's name in vain, perhaps. I mean, there's religious people that take God's name in vain all the time. And they still think they're religious. I remember going to breakfast a lot of times with one man from New York. He used to be a cutter, cutting garments in a garment factory up in New York. He was very good. He made good money. He was about 90 years old, Sam. I like Sam a lot. But when we got over in that cafe in the morning, he had the most foul mouth that I heard in a long time. He could have been a sailor. Because he cursed like a sailor, like they say. He went to synagogue every Sabbath. He went there on Friday night. He said Kadesh for his dead wife who died a few years before. He asked me to come sit down next to him one Friday night. I went over to see what their synagogue was like. And he saw me in the hallway. He said, oh, Richard, come on, sit with me. And he was, in some ways, the nicest guy. He really was. But what a foul mouth. And he was religious. I thought, how can he talk that way, using God's name in vain like that, and he goes to church every week? I didn't understand it. And then I had the same thing happen with my friend Al. I liked him a great deal. I miss him a lot. We had some very good talks. But every once in a while, he'd use God's name in vain. And he went to synagogue, too. He's a president of the synagogue a couple times. He said, I don't go there for religious. I go there because of the social. Well, he's honest anyway. But one time he took Christ's name in vain. I thought, well, why would he do that? He's a Jew. and he used Christ's name. Well, it's because of habit. That's the way they talk. Not them as Jews, but anybody a lot of times. What about Patton? Remember that? You ever see the movie on Patton? And I don't know if this exactly happened in real life, but he's supposed to be based on Laszlo's book, who wrote the book on him, a biographer. But anyway, they came in there and said, do you pray? Yeah, I pray every day. Taking God's name in vain. I mean, people laughed, and, you know, one time he asked the chaplain to get a prayer because they're going to go into battle and they're going to need God's help. And he says, what do you mean? Yeah, write off a real good one, he says. real good prayer, because we need some help. And he went to church. He was kind of religious in a sense. But self-righteousness, again, it was all right to kill all those Germans. He says, I don't want you boys to die for your country. We want you to help the Germans die for theirs. Remember that line in the film? And so he was quite a character. And he got the job done all right. He killed a lot of Germans. And they were the fastest, Third Army was the fastest advancing army in Europe for the United States. He got the job done all right in war. He loved war, he said. Does God love war? I don't think so. He does. He can make war. But he doesn't like it. How about verse 152? Concerning your testimonies, well, look at all your commandments are truth. Verse 151. They are near, O Lord, and all your commandments are truth. They're righteous and they're truth. That's why God wants us to follow truth, wherever it leads us. And that's why the church of God is so different from the churches in the world. Churches of the world went by different reasons. They went by traditions. They went by what happened before. They went by different regulations that their leaders gave them. Martin Luther is believed knew about the Sabbath. In fact, he said some nice things about the Sabbath being on a Saturday. But he never had his followers follow it. Still kept Sunday like the Catholics. And somebody told him, we can't do that because they'll say we're all Jewish. And you know how the Germans liked the Jews, even back then. They kicked them out in the Middle Ages. Made him wear yellow stars in the medieval times. Did you know that? Hitler didn't start that. He got it from the past. Even England kicked out Jews for 300 years. Didn't let them come back. So the English, Ephraim and Judah have had their problems, as the Bible said would happen. How about verse 142? Your righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and your law is the truth. Again, it's everlasting. Man's righteousness doesn't last. How long does a self-righteous person's righteousness last? As long as he lives. Dead. Finished. Can he give it to a lot of other people? Usually not. They'll have their own certain customized version of their righteousness. And when as long as you can use your mind to do that, you don't need God to do it, do you? That's what Satan was telling him. You don't need God. That's why there's such confusion in the world, because everybody has their own standard of what is right or wrong in their own mind. And they, as it says there in Romans 2, they accuse or they excuse. They accuse or excuse what they do. They accuse others of doing what they're doing that's contrary to what they think, me, self, thinks is right. Or they excuse what they do because of some rationalization they make. I wouldn't have killed that person if they weren't there. They showed up. It's their fault. I simply couldn't do anything else. Right? Driving drunk. Guy killed this man. I think you know about the story up there. Was it Parkland or something? Not Parkland, but up north on our side of the Everglades. And he had a Rolls Royce, a $200,000 convertible. He was drunk. And he ran over a guy and took off, killed him. Then they came back and found out who it was and where the wrecked car was and all that. And they put him up, and now he's going to go to prison. Well, he had the best lawyers because he's very, very rich. But what can I do? I was drunk. I didn't have any, I couldn't help myself. I'm a good guy. I wouldn't kill anybody. I have no idea to hurt anybody. Well, that's probably true. But he still is guilty. People do that, and it's universal. The communist has that. The fascist has that. The socialist has that. The Obama people have that. The non-Obama people have that. Take your pick, everybody. It's not a party. It's everybody. It's universal. Self-righteousness. Like I say, we have to watch out for it ourselves. What does God tell us to do? That's what we got to look at in our lives. How does God look at this when you're thinking about something? How would God look at it? According to his word. According to what he says. And then you're going to get on the right track. You know, if we're going to be one in the kingdom of God, we have to think like one. We have to think like God does. And that takes godly righteousness, not our own erroneous kind. I'll better stop here. Revelation 21, verse 5 shows you what kind of people are going to be in the kingdom, who won't. Also Revelation 22, verse 14 and 15 shows that, you know, people who are breaking God's law, who have their own righteousness, which is lawlessness many times, won't be there. But God's righteousness, that will prevail. That's why the church is so different from all other churches. They readily sometimes admit some things that they aren't doing right, according to the Bible. But then they will say, well, it's our tradition. It's what we've always done. And so continue. Look, the Comanches. I remember reading the book by Michener about Texas. Quite an interesting historical novel. And they went over to talk to the Comanches over in western Texas, who were, after they got prisoners, who were soldiers, and they weren't all dead. They had some who were still alive. They'd take them, and they'd torture them. Take off one finger at a time and torture them and skin them. Do all kinds of horrible things to them so they'd be in pain and suffer for days and days and days. And finally, they'd kill them. Somebody asked, why do you do that? Well, they're our enemies, and we've always done that. You know, like, it's a righteous thing to do. That's what we always do. I mean, what's wrong with that? They're our enemies. Nobody taught them God's righteousness, did they? They were ignorant of it, so they made their own emails full of evil, terrible evil. And that's what people do. They'll say, well, I don't like to do this, but we have to. I'll tell you one thing, so it's interesting. When I was going to University of Washington in Seattle, I got a job at Mutual Materials Company, which had masonry materials they sold to the different bricklayers and block people and the stone people and everything. And it was a real good job. It was half our time going to college at the same time. And the one fellow in the back who was a treasurer, I think, I'm not sure what job he had, but he was a German, American German. He wasn't born in Germany. He was born in the United States. And we were talking one day about the Holocaust. And I said, well, he was talking about that. And I said, well, and they went and they killed the men and they killed the women and the children, the little children. You know what he said to me? Well, they had to do it. I couldn't believe my ears. American. With that attitude, with that way of looking at stuff. Well, they had to do it. Like, what else could they do? Murder these little babies? Some enemies, huh? What did they do? How were they keeping the Germans from having a master race, you know? They were wrong place at the wrong time, I guess. But he rationalized that, well, they had to do it. They couldn't help it, you know. Beheading, it's like an ISIS person saying, after they beheaded some American or Brit newsman, well, they're our enemies. We had to do it. Yeah. We don't like doing that, but we have to do it for our cause, the greater good. Humanists do that. They'll say, we're doing this. We don't like to do this, but it's for the greater good. You ever hear that? The greater good. The Communist Manifesto by Engels and also Marx were really influenced by Satan when they said, the ends justify the means. You know what that means, don't you? Whatever you do that helps promote our end cause that we want to achieve, utopia, communist utopia, you can kill, you can steal, you can lie, you can rob banks, you can kill the children, kill anybody who's got any money. It all is substantiated for the final goal of our utopia. Okay, what is God's version of that? Just think about it. It's the opposite. The way you get there is all important. The means. The ends justify the means. While we're going to the kingdom of God, how do you get there? By self-righteousness, by lying, by stealing, by breaking God's commandments? Never. You won't get there. You won't achieve utopia. But if you do it by the means of how you live, it makes a big difference with God, doesn't it? How you get there. How you get there. What you do. How you are. The building God's character. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. We are involved with this laboratory of life, I call it. Longer I live, the more happy and glad that I'm so grateful for God's wonderful revelation to us. It's inspiring, so inspiring to think that we're doing something that is really more important than anything else is to build righteous, holy, godly character and be pleasing to God. I've got one scripture I looked at today that I didn't have in my notes, but in Ecclesiastes 2, who does he give wisdom to? It says, you know, if we took this fruit, we'd have wisdom. Abe thought. And that's what the implication she got from what Satan told her, that you know good from evil, so you'd be wise, like God, see? So she says, make us wise, this tree. Here's the one God gives wisdom to. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 26. God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. And joy. Wisdom, knowledge, and joy. To a man or to a woman who is good in his sight. But the sinner, he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give to him that who is good before God. But the thing is, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy to the person who is good in his sight. Who are trying to follow God's righteousness in their life. Oh, we don't do it perfectly. We make mistakes. Sometimes we slip. But vain goal is to work towards that. To be building the righteous, holy character of God. It's good for everybody. Why wouldn't the whole world want it? Because Satan is here now. But in the world tomorrow, it's going to be a beautiful thing when Satan is going to be taken out of the picture and influence. And only the truth will be propagated or taught. And no competition with error. And that's going to be wonderful. Let's look forward to that time. Keep growing in grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.